Welcome to The J. Kim Show, Hong Kong's first dedicated podcast on investing in Asia. It's no secret that Asia is home to some of the most dynamic, innovative, and game-changing companies in the world. Join us as we survey the land to find the most profitable investment opportunities that will allow you to capitalize off this next wave of wealth creation. If this is your first time listening, thank you for stopping by. This podcast is produced with the goal of providing actionable insights with every single episode. And now, onto the show.
This week's show guest is Chris McIntosh, founder of Capitalist Exploits, an investment community with over 30,000 members dedicated to finding asymmetric risk-reward investment opportunities. Chris founded and built several multi-million dollar businesses in the investment arena, including overseeing the deployment of over 30 million US dollars into venture capital opportunities and advising family offices internationally. Prior to this, Chris built a career at Invesco Asset Management, Lehman Brothers, JP Morgan Chase, and Robert Fleming's. Let's get on to the show.
Hey, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. And we're eager to hear your perspectives on global investing. So thanks for coming on.
No, you're welcome, Jay. I appreciate the outreach. And I hope you can bring something to the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you have a pretty unique perspective that a lot of our audience members will appreciate. So, Chris, maybe you could give us just a quick background on who you are and maybe how you came up.
You know, people often ask me, "What? Where are you from?" or "What are you?" Right? And I guess I'm a thoroughbred mongrel at this point. I've lived in seven different countries, and I grew up in Africa, in South Africa. And one of the, you know, if I look back and I think, what is, you know, some of the formative things that took place in my life? One of those was, I guess, my upbringing. I grew up in a middle to upper class environment. And I say that with respect to the schooling that I went to. However, my parents were decidedly not middle to upper class. You know, so but there was always this disconnect between my peers at school and what we were experiencing at home. My parents didn't ever have any money. They seemed to be completely broke all the time. And so that was actually one of the best gifts that I've ever had, was this realization pretty early on that I needed to get my own shit together. And there wasn't going to be anything there to sort of get me through college or anything of that nature. So that was, and then a strong desire to try and figure out the world was always kind of deep inset in my mind. And so I left Africa two weeks after I finished high school. I was fortunate enough to have a foreign passport, so I went and worked in London. And in that respect, so what I could do then was I could actually, the reason that I went there was twofold. One, was because I had a desire to actually just figure out the rest of the world. And the second really was because I needed some money, and I also wanted to study. So I studied law, but I couldn't afford to do so staying in South Africa. For starters, student loans, unlike much of the Western world, are structured, or were at the time, I don't know what they're like now, but they were structured in such a fashion that they were just like any other loan where you pay back, you know, every month. And so I was in the situation where I'd have to borrow a whole heap of money and, you know, within 4 weeks' time, I'd need to be paying back that loan. Interest rates at the time were exceeding 20%.
Wow.
So, you know, I did the math and I realized very quickly that this was just not an option. On the other hand, going and working in the UK, I had the ability to earn strong currency and I could still study via correspondence. So I would basically work all day and then study until 1-2 o'clock every morning at nights via correspondence. And I could pay for all of my education in, I can't remember exactly what it was, Jay, but it was like I paid for an entire semester, all my studies, all my books, everything with like maybe a week's pay. It might have even been less than that. So, you know, so financially I was on the up. And, you know, you're young. Like when you're young, you don't need to sleep, right? So yeah. You don't. And so I did that. And then I was just very fortunate to actually be at at a juncture in history that was fortunate for anybody that was involved in finance. So I had this belief or this idea that I wanted to do law, and that was actually just on the back of reading too many John Grisham books when I was a teenager, which I then realized that wasn't quite what I was after, and I became very interested in the finance and economics and history side of things. And then I got involved and managed to get some work in the investment banks, which at the time, you'll remember this was mid to late 90s when we were really just getting into that dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. And the banks were printing money, and they were hiring pretty much any idiot, and I was one of those idiots. So I managed, without an education, to get without a tertiary education, kind of halfway through it, to be employed in the banks, and then worked my ass off there. I was quite fortunate with a mentor who realized some potential and took me under his wing, and I landed up moving between three different, I went from Lehman's to what was called RF & Co, which was the last standing British investment bank, which was then subsequently swallowed by Chase Manhattan, which was then swallowed by JPM. And became JP and Chase. So I kind of went through that whole transition with all those banks with one boss, essentially, and got promoted all the way through very, very quickly. So that was how I got involved, essentially, in the financial markets. But really, because for many years now, over 15 years, I've done the math, I've been an entrepreneur, I've been doing my own thing. And that came on the back of that very same boss literally turning around and saying to me, Chris, you really shouldn't be here. And what he was saying there was that my mindset was one that was not going to work in a corporate environment. I always questioned everybody. I didn't care if it was the big boss. And, you know, and it wasn't trying to be a belligerent little snot. It was just that I had a curiosity and I had a desire to figure out the truth. And I also realized a lot of things in that space. You know, we were working with fund management. RF & Co were one of the major fund managers, especially in emerging markets. And, you know, so I was dealing a lot with fund managers all around the world. And one thing that really struck me was that in the institutional space, there is this outsourcing of responsibilities that takes place. And I think it's just prevalent in any large or many large corporate cultures, where people basically act like sheep. And so where you've got valuations, where you've got all sorts of things that don't necessarily make sense, and you question them, these guys literally just look to following the herd and they justify their positions according to what everybody else is doing. And you understand it because come a Thursday night, everybody goes to the same pub. You know, it doesn't matter if you're Deutsche and, you know, Joey down the roads at Lehman's and Freddie up the roads at Bear Stearns. Like, you know, they all basically congregate in the same little pool of pubs, and at least that's what the life like is like in London. And the sort of thinking process tends to be very similar, and you get a herding mentality. And there's not, like, I had always this belief that in-depth research was done, which it sort of is, but not to the way that you think it is. And that's also why you have these market events where people get caught out and you look and you think, shit, that was Goldman Sachs and they just got hammered. How the
right.
fuck happened? Right. And the reason behind it is because they tend to be the fund managers in it often are needing to present quarterly results. And if they don't get those quarterlies out, and they're not beating the market on a quarterly basis or at least tracking the market, then they get redemptions of capital, so they just land up being trend followers as opposed to actually trying to identify real opportunities, because you're forced into that bucket, right? And that's, you know, it's not just an institutional problem, right? It doesn't, you know, unless you've got a fund like the fund I run now is basically small money that I know, right? And so the guys don't redeem and they know what the strategy is. So that's cool. But when you're going and you're dealing essentially with bigger pools of capital where you don't have that relationship with your LPs, you know, they're comparing you to everybody else and they're just going to pull their money if you haven't got a quarter in that that's, you know, as good as they want it to be. So then you're forced into basically following everybody else just so that you don't fall out of favor. So that was kind of an interesting education for me around that space. And it's one of the reasons that for many, many years I refused to set up a fund, and I preferred to just run my own capital. Mm. So that was kind of, but I guess the thing that got me really involved in what I'm doing now was this event back in, it was 1998. I think I was at Lehman's, and all of my spare time I was studying markets, and I came across the oil market, and I was researching and diligencing it in depth till long hours into the early hours of the morning. And really, and then discussing these markets with oil traders and things like that at the bank. And I came very much hard down on the idea that oil was massively underpriced. I mean, I was as convinced of this trade in my own head as the Pope is that there's a Christian God, or as Hillary Clinton is that Russian hackers stole her election. Like I was convinced. And this is important because I was in my early 20s, and I took my entire life savings, which at that point was just a few thousand pounds, because remember, I was still paying for education and so on. And I took all of that, and not only did I just invest it in like an oil ETF, but I invested a J in option contracts. Okay, mm-hmm. So you obviously understand how option contracts work in that they expire worthless unless you're right. So yeah. I was like putting everything on the line.
Wow.
And then I had the absolute, could say the worst thing happened to me. It was actually the best thing that happened to me. This was oil, if you remember, back in 98, was trading around about 20 bucks a barrel. And in August of 1998, it bottom ticked around $17. I bought my oil. I bought 2-year call options deep out of the money, 2-year call options staggered across different strikes, but all maturing on the 2-year time frame. And I did that when oil was about between $20 and $22 a barrel. And then it literally, I think it was like July, I placed the trades. In August, it hit like just under $17. And then it did nothing but go straight up, okay? And I bought within a whisker of its all-time lows. And if you go back and you have a look, that was basically the decade trade, right? From late 98 through 2008, when we had the GFC, it ran from $17 to about $156.
Yeah.
So, and obviously you've got leverage with options, and the deeper out of the money you are, the more leverage you have. So my options were 2 years, and if you go back and you have a look, 2 years we got to about 48 bucks, 46, 48, which and I let them run to expiry, right? So it was almost like 2 years bang on. Come August, it peaked. It was an intermediate peak. September, October, it dropped back down. And then it carried on, but obviously I had my time frame was literally August, and so anyway, the long and short of it is that I took like a few thousand pounds and I turned it into six figures.
Wow!
And that obviously I turned around and I was like, well, clearly I'm a genius. I mean, watch out, Soros. It was a spectacular trade, absolutely spectacular. And at the time, I was living in a house with a whole bunch of backpackers and. You know, it was like a house. We had, I think, 13 people living in it with like 5 bedrooms. I mean, it was just one of these, extremely cheap accommodation type things because that was what I could afford at the time. And, you know, many of my roommates were guys just pouring pints in the pub and things like that. And I never said anything to anybody because I quite didn't know how to go home and explain to people that I could have actually at the time gone and bought a nice beautiful apartment in the Docklands, which I should have done. But I didn't. And I didn't because I was clearly a genius. And so then the inevitable happened, right? Hubris took hold and I lost 100% of that money, all of it. And spectacularly quickly, right? And what I learned in the whole process was that position sizing would matters. Firstly, I position sized incorrectly in that first deal, clearly, but, you know, because it's one in every now and then that you get it completely right. And if you go and you look, I could have literally had the same thesis 2 years earlier, and I would have been right that the bull market in oil was coming. But if I bought those two-year calls, I would have lost 100% of that money because I would have bought at like $24, right? And 2 years later, it would have been at $24, thereabouts. And time value would have eroded and I would have lost all my money. So it was really important when I went back and I analyzed the whole thing, I realized that I just had been completely lucky and I'd completely over positioned in that trade. And it was just a really good lesson. And it was, you know, fundamental lesson to actually make all that money and then just lose 100% of it, which just destroys you. And you sit there and you think, what is going on? Why am I so bad at this? And so that was, you know, that was just some really super important lessons for me in my early 20s around a couple of things. You know, like I learned that homework pays off, right? If you do your homework, it can pay off. Position sizing is really crucial. And then structuring the trade. Like I could have actually structured that trade again 2 years earlier, but if I'd A, position size correctly, and then B, put on a trade where I didn't have a time problem, right? Because you can identify a trend and an opportunity, but none of us actually know when that's going to turn. And you can use charts and you can use all these things that can help try and guide you as to when you got a turning point in the market. But I've been doing this long enough to know that there is no crystal ball. And so you want to try and portfolio run a proper portfolio. So what I should have done is probably put a much greater percentage into something like an ETF, and I would have made a killing, right? I would have still run from 20 to 150, and I could have had stops and that kind of risk management in place, and I would have caught this massive trade, which you literally only need one trade like that through any, you know, any cycle, whether it be a business cycle or credit cycle, and you can do extremely well. So I learned a lot of lessons in that. And then I left the corporate world. I went off and built a real estate business. I saw opportunities in that space. Again, I was just looking at these trends and in credit markets, in valuations and all sorts of stuff. And I literally leveraged the hell out of my balance sheet. And you know, made,
which countries were you looking at real estate?
So Australia, New Zealand, where I'm sitting right now, were the main places, and a few sort of dabblings elsewhere, but those were the critical places because I was on the ground and I could manage what I was doing. And then I began trading, like a trade. I realized in the real estate market, you could just trade it like any other contract, like I've been doing at the banks. So I would create option contracts as I could see a boom taking place. I'll give you a quick example where you've got, I mean, anytime you've got a large land mass, if you chop up that land mass, you create more liquidity, right? Take Hong Kong, right? If you've got, let's say Hong Kong Island was completely uninhabited, didn't have anything built on it, that would be worth a particular figure. Let's just pluck a number and say it's $1 trillion. It's probably quite close. If you go and chop that up, right, and you chop it up into, I don't know, 1,000 square meter plots of land, which can now be built on, and you can have tower blocks and all this other kind of stuff, the aggregate of all of those is much, much more than $1 trillion. Right? Because you're actually just creating liquidity, right? Because you and I can't go in and buy Hong Kong Island. It's like, whoa, it's too expensive. So who can buy it? Well, you're talking about big, big money, sovereign wealth funds, all this kind of nonsense. However, when you chop it up into smaller pieces, we can go, oh, yeah, we can buy that. Or we can club together some buddies and we'll go and develop a particular piece of land. So then it just creates much, much more liquidity. So I was identifying growth trends of that nature, and I would go out and essentially do all my due diligence on a particular area, on where infrastructure was going in, And I basically try and front run infrastructure and then go in and speak to farmers, for example, and say, hey, I want your this particular piece of land, your this paddock that you got cows grazing in. And what would you give it to me for? And then instead of just putting down all the capital and buying, you know, 20 acres or whatever it is of land, I would say, how about you give me the option to buy that land over the next 5 years? Right? So instead of me paying you $500,000, I will pay you $20,000 upfront or 25 for the next 2-3 years. And if I don't settle on the deal, you get to keep the 25 grand. And if I do, then I agree to buy it for $500,000. So then I'd do that. And then I would go off and I'd get developers who would, you know, because I had basically done all the development work. So I knew what the metrics on that land looked like from a developer's perspective. So I knew how they would value it, right? And then I would just go and pull them in and go, hey, guys, I just found a particular piece of land. And then I'd option the contract to them. And I would turn my 25 and sell it to them for like $800,000-$900,000. And then, yeah, so I was doing that as well as just building up a portfolio of real estate assets and things like that. And then I liquidated the entire lot in mid to late 2006, and kind of went back to just spending time thinking about the world, thinking about global macro markets, which I'd always loved. And I'd gotten away from because I was just so busy doing my stuff.
Was the reason you stepped back from the real estate thing, you were just bored of it, tired of it, too much work, or were you just wanted to step back and focus again on just markets and the world?
It was more just a matter that the opportunities were just much, much more difficult to come by. So I'll give you an example. When I first started, and it was literally a three-year run, when I first started, I was going out and I was buying what I call shitbox houses, just these little kind of three-beddy things, which I could buy them, rent them out, and cover all of my expenses just with the rental income on a yield basis. Is buying stuff at between a 12% and 15% cap rates. Finance rates are about 6-6.5 points. So I was cash flow positive on all the stuff, and then I just keep refinancing, and yeah, so I had huge leverage, but my cash flows were strong, and so I could weather cash flow problems. And then I would, at the same time, I'd trade, just like the example I gave you. And then I'd take that capital that I made from trading and just dump it in reduced debt. So I was kind of building a lot of equity and increasing cash flows all the time, and just kept recycling. Like, I've always, from my upbringing, you know, I saved diligently, and I've literally always done that. I've like always saved between 50 and 80% of everything I earn, I save. And I just live to make sure that I can live on, you know, 20% or between 20 and 50%. It keeps you actually growing your wealth much, much more quickly. And it just also keeps you humble, you know. So, like, I live in a very nice area, but the people all around me all got mortgages, you know, like $1 million mortgages. And, you know, they drive Porsches and things of that nature, but there's just a huge amount of debt. I like a Porsche, but I don't have a Porsche yet. And it's like, I just want to make sure that if I can keep all of that, at that level where I'm only spending like 20% and I got no debt, then it's just, I just feel much more secure with that. And I know that all of my capital is going towards making me stronger and wealthier, as opposed to just buying stuff, which, you know, it gives you
appreciating assets,
and it gives you that temporary boost, and you feel good. It's like an ice cream, you know, that was really good, and then and you get fat, right? So, so in the real estate market, the cap rates essentially went from 12. I was buying them like net 12, gross 15 often, and they went all the way down, Jay, to 4, right? And that was just because real estate literally went up like 3-4 times in value. So my equity had risen, but my cash flows hadn't gone anywhere, right? The cash flows are still about the same. And at the end of the day, cash flow is, like I've always gone, cash flow is king. And so I couldn't find that many opportunities in terms of actually buying to hold anything. And I locked, and I stopped and I thought, this doesn't make sense. Like, this no longer makes sense. Like, And then I had gone into commercial, and I was seeing commercial investors buying, you know, commercial real estate with finance rates, because remember, finance rates and commercial are much, much higher than on residential, and your leverage ratios are more stringent, right? And I was seeing stuff going out the door at, you know, 4, 4.5 for not like prime commercial, and finance rates on commercial was 7, 7.5. And I was like, who the fuck is buying this stuff? What are they? And of course, it's the old game of, you know, it's been going up 10% a year, so it's going to keep going up 10% a year. And
yeah,
that might be the case, right? But you're taking on risk and again, position sizing. Like, so I just felt something's wrong here. And then I went to an event, which was put on by, you know, one of these so-called gurus in real estate. And a friend said, oh, you should come and listen to this guy. Anyway, I went up there and I listened to what he had to say. And he stood up on a stage and he said, we will never again in this country experience cash flow real estate. And I just sat there and I thought, that is the most asinine comment I've ever heard, because this guy's just never read any history. And I literally drove back home, and on the phone on the way, I just contacted brokers and I just put everything on the market. And I liquidated an entire portfolio of millions and millions of dollars of real estate within about 6 months. So that was kind of, you know, and it was, so then I sat on the beach going, okay, what do I do with my time? I can't play golf. I'm shitty at golf and I don't want to retire. So what am I going to do? And I spent a lot of time researching, reading, traveling. And then I realized that there was this shift of capital going from the public markets into the private for all a host of reasons. One of those was regulatory. There's a bunch of reasons. And I wanted to participate in that. So I started off doing a bunch of angel investments, early stage stuff. And then I did that for like 2-3 years. And then eventually I got to the point where I bumped into another guy who got introduced to me. And he was a marketing dude. And he basically came and said, wow, I love what you're doing. This sounds fantastic. I can sell what you're telling me. And I was like, oh, okay. What does that look like? Anyway, so that was the beginning of the blog, which I set up, or which was similar. But in the original, it was designed, I wasn't really going to do anything there. I was just going to do my thing. And him being a marketing guy, I was going to, you know, market it. And I didn't want to, I'd come from the investment banking world, so I had problems with the model, the investment banking model, because it's very opaque. You often don't actually know the underlying contracts that are in place, certainly in the private equity space. Who's getting paid what, why, who's got a bias, who's got an interest, where and how. And I had an unfortunate experience in a deal which, well, I'll say unfortunate, I got involved in a deal where there was an investment banker that was helping raise capital for the deal. And the structuring of all of the contracts and basically part of the management of equity and share options and all of that kind of stuff. He was sort of meant to handle that, and he didn't really have that much expertise in it. And long and short of it was, I went in and I did all that work. I structured all the deals. I helped raise capital. I did all the stuff, and the deal worked out really well. And I made about 3 times my money within about two and a half years. But the investment banker made more money on the deal than I did, and he never put a cent in, and that kind of just pissed me off. So
yeah.
Then I was like, okay, if I'm going to do something, I'm not going to do the investment banking model, because it's always, you know, it's like the old deal. Like, you bring me a deal, Jay. I go, that sounds like a good deal. How much are you putting in? Oh, no, I'm not putting anything into this. I go, well, you're not putting your money. Why the fuck should I put my money in?
Right.
So I didn't want that model. And so I set up a business where I said, okay, I'm putting my capital at work. What I want to have is a situation where I can bring more capital to the table because it gives me leverage, right? If I come in, so let's take that piece of real estate in Hong Kong we want to develop. And I've got, I don't know, $1 million. You've got $1 million, but this thing's going to cost us $20 million. We go, okay, we've got to club people together. And if we go to the owner of the real estate at the moment, we could ask him for terms on finance and all this kind of stuff, and it might cost us $20 million. But if we can come in with a cash offer and we can do a whole lot of other stuff, we'll get it for 18. We've just saved ourselves $2 million, right? That's worth doing. And if so, we can club together that money and we can go and we can get ourselves a better deal for all of us. And so that was kind of the premise that I built a venture capital business on. And we did that for a number of years, and I exited that back in beginning of 2016. I'd seen a whole lot of things taking place. I mean, we were financing deals at the beginning, you know, kind of apples to apples, $5 million pre-money. And today those deals are 25, 30. It's the same deal. It's the same deal. And so valuations have just gotten wacky, especially in kind of the Silicon Valley space.
Sure.
So for me to get a return that is, you know, it's really risky stuff. So you're going into early stage VC. You're realizing that like 60, 70% of these things are just going to vaporize. And it doesn't matter how good they look, they're going to go away.
I think that's even generous. It's probably more higher than
sure. Yeah. And look, that's doing your homework, right? So, you know, then I need to have a really decent return. And if I'm investing in a company at 25 mil pre or 30 mil pre, and they don't really have, they got an idea, like they got a PowerPoint, right? And a few PhDs. I'm like, shit, for me to get a 10X, this has got to become, you know, $100, $200 million company. Is that realistic? What space are they in? And you kind of start doing the math and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. So I wanted to basically transition that whole business, which is too difficult with the structure, with the way it had been originally structured. And I wanted to get involved in, I'd already begun doing a lot of the stuff that I'm doing now. And so I sort of slowly transitioned, and then I just cut it off and I said, okay, no more of that. And I literally gave the business away to the guy that I founded it with, which kind of shocked him at the time, but I needed to do what I wanted to do. So that's when I set up the fund that I run now. And then about a year later, I set up the advisory service that I got. And it's really just dealing with trying to identify these major trends. You know, if I go back and I look at what it is that has been successful and what has been unsuccessful in my career, I realize that one of the things that I managed to do, luckily, was identify major sort of trends and get behind them, because you can be lazy. You can really cock up and still make money if you're behind a massive trend. You're not, you're not that salmon swimming up water. And really that's one of the things that, you know, we target now is looking for these massive structural shifts and trends and looking for essentially asymmetry, you know, where the perceived risk is much, much higher than the actual risk. And then just positioning early and then, you know, ensuring that you structure and your position size. So I'm not like that kid when I was 20, you know, buying oil contracts. You can buy oil contracts, but, you know, you do it with like 1% of your portfolio, not 100%.
Well, I think, thanks for sharing your story. It sounds like you've had a pretty wild and diverse background and experience, but it kind of brings you full circle back to where you are now. And I think just a few comments, you know, when you talk about, we were talking about fund management before, and I think I absolutely agree with you. I mean, being at a fund now myself, it's actually quite the way they structure it and the need for, you know, quarterly, monthly returns, annual returns, even annual returns, that time frame, putting a constraint on that, it really is counter to the craft of investing, because you shouldn't actually have a gun to your head and say and be told you have to make returns in this amount of time. And that's essentially what institutional investors are doing. I mean, it's investing psychology, human psychology is the same, whether you're a retail guy or you're a large institution, you're still chasing the same thing. And so that is one of the frustrations I found working in the asset management, like institutional asset management space. But secondly, on sort of now that you've come full circle and now you're back to just looking at trends and opportunities, and I know you write about it a lot over at your blog, and you said you have your fund. So maybe you can share with the audience a couple, anything exciting that you're looking at right now. And are there any opportunities that excite you within Asia that you might be worth talking about?
Yeah, so there's a long and short answer to that question. Let me try and go midstream. without a doubt, I think the biggest anomaly that we're sitting with today is that the last decade that we've had central bank policies have been going directly against economic trends in motion. And so I guess the question you're going to ask is like, what do you think, or the way that I think about it is like, what happens when you have monetary policy, because monetary policy is affected by at a political level, right? And so if we go back and we have a look at the period post GFC, one of the most significant, which is easily one of the most anomalous periods in central bank history, we had the US central bank, the English, British central bank, Japan, Australia, Canada, literally every developed world central bank acted in unison and in coordination. Mm-hmm. That was and still is unprecedented in history. So you had this period of time where central bank coordination and policy was essentially the same thing. Part of that, you know, we can debate on, you know, what brought that about. One of the main things that brought it about was actually, if you look at the political leadership in those countries, it was fairly benign. There were the rhetoric coming out of the at the political level was quite muted across the world. Yeah, the only one that I could say was probably not muted in that respect was China and Xi and Abe in Japan, who are both strongmen, right? But the interesting thing was that what Abe and Kuroda were doing anyways was just happened to be the same thing that the rest of the central bank wanted to do, which was easy monetary policy. And so like the opening of swap lines, all of those policy measures took place in an environment which basically everything went down the same route. And that has led us to this bubble in sovereign fixed income, right? And you'll remember back in July of 2016, we had the Swiss 50 year went negative and we had 13 trillion trading at negative yields. And all of that was this environment which is very much conducive to one strategy. Now, one of the things that, you know, I've been talking about a lot is looking at things outside of just monetary policy. We know what that looks like. Every analyst out there, all of your guys at your fund, all my guys, all of my friends that I talk to running, you know, $100 billion funds, all that stuff, we all know what the mechanics of that look like, right? The poured over Fed statements and all that kind of stuff. What people, I think, have been neglecting to look at is how a political shift, which often comes on the back of a zeitgeist shift, on the back of a populace that is actually simmering and building discontent underneath that political framework, how that then changes that political framework, and then how that political framework then as a consequence changes the dynamics of monetary policy. So if we go back and we look at that, you have today political leadership, which is not accommodative. It's not accommodative in any way, shape, or form like it used to be, right? So all you got to do is think about the UK and Europe, right? It's not what it used to be, right? We've had Brexit, which was something that I wrote about. Mm-hmm. And people were like, oh, how did you sort of identify that that was a real possibility? And it was all these sort of non-monetary type. It's not something that you were going to pull up a statistic and go, oh yeah, okay, this is what it is. If you have to look at the US and Europe, it's not all the same thing. Europe and Russia, it's not all the same thing from literally 5-10 years ago. The US and Russia, right? So you get the picture. That political environment is fragmented and it's been strong quote unquote strong leadership that has been elected to power, right? And what happened in Brexit was they were actually looking for strong leadership. When I say strong, I'm using that as a term for we can debate whether it's actually strong or not, right? Hitler was a strong leader. Napoleon was a strong leader, right? So that's essentially what the when a social structure is under pressure and it's looking for alternatives, one of our major faults as human beings is that we look for a savior, we look for a god, we look for an individual, a man on a white horse. We look for not a collective, but for something that's strong, something that's extremely decisive, and often can be polarizing. So that's essentially what is getting elected into power. We've seen it in in your neck of the woods. You got Duterte. Duterte is a perfect example of that. He's a comedic one, but she is a strong man. Abe is a strong man. Obviously, Trump is a strong man. Le Pen, Brexit, same thing there. They were looking for that. There isn't currently anybody that you could look at and say, hey, that's a strong man. But that's essentially what the society was willing to take and elect. And that environment gave them the ability to go, hey, what, we want some big changes. We want something dramatic. And they elected it. At the time, there wasn't anybody standing there who was saying, I'm going to take up that mantle and I'm going to run with it. There's Nigel Farage, who he led that charge, but then stepped back from it because he's not wanting to be that strong man to run the country or anything of that nature. But he was the leadership, or part of the leadership, that was saying we want to change. So anyway, so you've got these political structures which are all changing the dynamics, and nobody's really paying much attention to the knock-on effects, the secondary effects of that. And so if you think about that sovereign debt market and how it's actually being held together, any time that there's been any problem, there's been swap lines that have been opened, there's been coordination, there's been policy incentives that have held it together. And that world's ended. I believe that world's ended. And so the next time we see any sorts of pressures on the system, it's going to be a different outcome. And so we're very much focused on saying, what takes place, right? We're looking for these events that could take place that could have that breaking of the structural system that we have today, and then saying, what benefits and what doesn't benefit, and how can we position accordingly? And then you dig into sectors and you dig into areas, and sometimes then are overvalued, and then you can't play. You say, okay, that sector could probably do well, but you know what? Valuation is really high at the moment, so it's not going to give us the asymmetry that we're looking for. But then there's many other sectors where you look and you go, wow, that's actually quite an interesting area. And so, like my head trader, he comes at things from a very different angle. He'll look at sectors that are out of favor, and he'll look at these markets. And I come at it from a different angle. And often, where the two collide, he'll be coming in from just saying, "Hey, look at this space here. This is crazy. This market's down 90%. It's got this, that, and the other thing." And we look and start getting my guys to research the fundamentals of it. And I'm coming at it from that sort of geopolitical macro framework, and often where those collide is where we see opportunity and huge asymmetry. So that's kind of how I think about it. To your point on Asia, I think that I'm convinced that over the next, my generation, my kids' generation, there's only one place that you really need to be focused on, and that's Asia. It's got so much going for it, socially, politically, economically. It is absolutely, definitely the place to be. So from a long-term trend perspective, that seems like a no-brainer to me. I do believe that as we go through the next event horizon, I think that there's going to be a huge opportunity to buy growth in those markets, because I think that there's going to be a sucking sound that comes out of them, not because they're not valuable and not because they don't present value, but just by sheer dynamics of capital flows. And I'll give you a little bit of an example. So, like, I've got a friend that works at Temasek and is explaining this to me, like probably a year ago now, maybe more, where he's moving capital in cash markets. And he's got to move like $4 billion or something like that, and he needs it net settled like now. And so he said to me, look, it's euro yen dollar. He can't buy Norwegian kroner. He can't buy New Zealand dollars. He can't buy any of these currencies because he's going to move the market too much. And so he's forced into shifting between these three ugly girls on the stage and trying to pick one of them to take home for the night. and that entire dynamic is what has actually held a lot of this together. And when that breaks at some point, and I'm leaning towards thinking that we're going to have a huge problem in debt markets in Europe, which will kind of then force capital to start picking, and we'll see. I still believe that there's a high probability that capital is going to shift into the dollar. I know the dollar bears, your typical newsletter writer that's, like selling fear and, US is going to die and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
That just forget about all that. Just look at capital flows and why capital flows and liquidity. I think that you're going to have a shift of capital going back into the deepest liquid pool, which is US markets and treasuries. And so I think the next crisis brings that. And in that environment, then emerging markets and Asia, a lot of that could potentially come under pressure. But that will be the time when you want to literally – you want to have a shopping basket and you want to buy for the long haul, because that's where you need to be for the next. You want to put your kids through college and, for starters, you probably should put your kids in college in Asia. But that's kind of how I think about stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Chris. I think the audience is going to get a lot out of your your thoughts and your insights, and thanks for sharing with us sort of your thought process and your backstory. So we appreciate your time. Where can our audience members find you, follow you, connect with you, maybe read some of your work that you're doing?
Yeah. So obviously there's the blog that I set up, which is capitalistexploits.com or .at. So that's just capitalist exploits, one word. They can follow me on there. And the fund's closed, so that's kind of not at some point we'll open it, and it's only open to new accredited and investors. But so that's kind of just by the side. There's nothing to follow there, but you can follow the work that I do on the blog and the research advisory that we do, macro research advisory. We're just literally dedicated towards trying to find asymmetry. That you can find that on the blog as well. Yeah.
Cool. And is the advisory, is that for more geared towards institutions, or can it be for individuals as well?
So we've got both in it. There are quite a few asset managers, hedge funds, and it runs the gamut, like from guys with $750 million under management through to guys who got, 20 grand to invest and just looking for those sorts of opportunities. So the one thing is, like, it's not intended to be an entire portfolio. It's a portion where you would take a portion of your portfolio and say, I'm looking for these asymmetric opportunities, and I'm going to just dedicate this bucket, if you will, to these particular opportunities. So the whole time frame behind that, which is pretty much mirrored in the fund, is, more like a 5-year time frame. I don't really care about noise in the market over the next 6 months or anything like that. I'm looking for these major right. trends. And you go back to the oil example, right? So, like, if I'd done that trade 2 years earlier How do you do that where you actually position size it properly? You take the right, you structure the trade correctly so that you can actually get that trade right. So that's will we provide in the research advisor, we'll provide a whole lot of different strategies to actually go out because everybody's different. And so like your hedge fund manager's got hundreds of millions of dollars, he will probably have the ability to go and take a portion of that and do some futures trading and maybe options or whatever it is, and then another portion into a number of equities or whatever it might be. But if you're managing a smaller pool of capital, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000, something like that, then you'd probably look and go, oh, I'm not gonna go and put into options necessarily. I'm just gonna look for something that's got gives me the longevity. I don't have to worry about time horizons as much. I'm not gonna get the same sort of upside, but I'm hitting these trends. So we try and cover all of that in the advisor, and then it's quite cool. I just built a community as well, which people come in and they all talk to each other. And just look, I don't pretend to have all the answers, maybe not even half the answers. And, you know, I've got some ridiculously smart clients who they're specialists in their own sectors. And so seeing that sort of interplay of trade ideas is really quite cool. Within the community.
Awesome. So we'll definitely check that out. So thanks again, Chris. Appreciate your time. And we'll get the audience, we'll get your site and everything linked up down below. So appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jane. Take care.
All right. Bye now. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. All the show notes and links can be found over at jkimshow.com. Come back often and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the next exciting episode of The J. Kim Show. As always, I'd love to hear your questions, comments, or future guest suggestions. You can find me on Twitter at jkimmer. That's JAYKIMMER. See you in the next episode.